It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's a magic marker. A felt pen.
It's a mistake.
It's a trap.
It's a fucking comedy.
It's quiet. Maybe too quiet.
It's all happening.
It's a good day to die.
It's a good day to talk about movies.
Welcome back. It is a good day to talk to Omar Farouk. I am your host, Duncan. Joining me, as always, is Gardner.
Welcome back, folks. We have a really fun one for you today. I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, should be fun to share this with you guys. Hopefully you enjoy it. You are listening right now to GDT. And here on GDT, we talk about movies and TV shows we love and interview independent filmmakers. Every Friday, we have an interview with an independent filmmaker or someone else related to the filmmaking industry. So that's what you're listening to right now, where today we will be interviewing independent filmmaker Omar Farouk. In addition to these Friday full-length episodes, we also have some bonus episodes for you. On Tuesdays, we have the MPU episodes where myself, CB, Mac, and Jalen go through the MCU movie by movie. This week, we did The Avengers, and we've previously done all the movies up to The Avengers. And next week, we will be discussing Iron Man 3. In addition to going through the MCU anytime there's a new superhero show or movie, be it Marvel, DC, or something independent, we will also be covering that on those shows and taking a break from the MCU for that. So when Ms. Marvel finishes up, when Thor 4 drops, whenever we get the next season of Invincible, and obviously many more examples, we will be discussing those on the Tuesday episodes. Also, we'll be doing a recap of season 3 of The Boys on those Tuesday episodes when that wraps up in a couple weeks. But right now, we actually had a little crossover on our bonus Thursday episodes. That's right, we also have a Thursday bonus episode where we talk about a new movie, a new TV show, something relevant, or we have a guest on to talk about one of their favorites. This week, yesterday, we dropped an episode on the first 6 episodes of season 3 of The Boys, which have already dropped on Amazon Prime. So we had most of the MPU squad on from the Tuesday episodes for that Thursday bonus episode. So if you missed that, check it out, and then stay tuned for more of those Thursday episodes where, like I said, we talk about usually something new, like a movie or TV show, or something just relevant, like old Batman movies leading up to a new Batman movie would be a good example. Or we also sometimes just have a guest on to talk about one of their favorite older movies sometimes, so it doesn't even have to be relevant in that case. But a lot of fun on those Thursday bonus episodes, and stay tuned for those, or check out our back catalog. We also have Monday episodes usually. Right now they're on hiatus, but Nyatsva hosts those. We're looking for a new topic for those, but I think if you stay tuned, you might find a little Dune conversation on those Monday episodes coming up soon, so stick around for those. They'll be coming back soon. But if you want to check out the back catalog, we had a 8 or 9 episode run on Nostalgia, the short film that myself and some other GDT members are working on. So if you want to know what I'm talking about there, go check that out, and you'll be able to figure out what I'm referring to by listening to those episodes if you want. Check out all those episodes that we've released already and stay tuned for the future ones. But like I said, today you are listening to the full episode where we are talking to Omar Farouk about his independent filmmaking. If you want to check out his work, you can look it up on YouTube just by searching his name, A-M-M-A-R, and then his last name is Farouk, F-A-R-O-O-Q. And if you search him up, you'll find some of his shorts, like The Speech is a good example of one, but there's many more on there, so check them all out. We talked to Omar about what he's done in the past, what he already has released, what he's working on right now, and what's coming up in the future as well. So I think it was a lot of fun. Always good to get different aspects of filmmaking and different insight from different points of view and different perspectives. So cool to have another independent filmmaker on the show. And I think he had some cool insight. So stay tuned for that. Here it is, right now, our interview with Omar Farouk.
We are joined now by a very special guest. Omar Farouk, an independent filmmaker, is here with us today to talk about his work. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Duncan. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're really excited to get into your work, but before we do, I gave a very brief introduction to you right there. You're obviously an independent filmmaker, but can you give us a little bit of a backstory on what that means to you, how you would describe yourself to someone who may not have heard of you?
So I come off as someone who has lived his life in 3 different countries. I was born in Pakistan, and till my early teenagers, I lived there, and then I moved to England. I lived there for about 7 years. And after that, I moved to the States, which was about 5 years ago. And that cultural mix that I was a part of in different parts of the world had a huge influence on me in a way that I was exposed to a lot of stories. And I've always loved people as a person. I mean, I love hearing to their stories and everything. So I did go through a lot of stories. I met a lot of interesting people. And that flux kind of made me express these stories and, you know, kind of wants me to, makes me feel to, bring these stories out to people. And that was basically the main inspiration that somehow led me towards filmmaking.
How would you say that that background manifests itself in the stories that you tell?
See, the thing is that I have been a part of quite a lot of different people, actually. And what I've observed in all of them is, even if you have different languages, no matter what race you're from or what part of the world you're from, the emotional capability of a human is nearly similar. I mean, a father here in the States or a father in Sri Lanka on the other end of the world would somehow have the same character arc as we, you know, as you understand. And that kind of makes you realize that if you've got an emotionally correct story that can express the inner inhibitions of people throughout the world, it kind of connects with everyone. For example, I was in Pakistan when I was, I think, about 4 or 5 years old, and we never had any copyright laws over there. And that meant that we were exposed to all kind of free stuff, you know, all these films. There was a lot of theft in the market, and, you know, there was just a lot of downloading, streaming, and all that kind of stuff. And we just went through all these films and had a global exposure. I mean, I remember having Tom Cruise's Top Gun poster in my room when I was growing up. And I was a kid in Pakistan who had nothing to do with it. But, you know, the global phenomenon that film became at that time, it connected the world. So watching it now in theaters again kind of makes me reconnect with that nostalgia and, you know, brings that emotion back that, yeah, the stories connect people. Yeah.
And I know this will be releasing on, I believe it'll be July 2nd when it comes out. It might be the 1st. I'm not looking at my calendar right now, but it'll be releasing this Friday. But news of today, so the past, if you're listening to this in the present as a listener right now, it just passed $1 billion, Top Gun 2. So,
oh, yes.
Yeah, I think it's the 50th film of all time to pass $1 billion in the highest grossing of Tom Cruise's career. So I just had to throw that in there because obviously, as you just mentioned, it's sweeping the world again, right?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Very cool stuff there and great answers on that. I don't want to go too far into this interview, though, without telling our audience where they can find your work. Because if someone's listening to this right now and they haven't seen your films yet, they might be wondering. We aren't going to spoil anything. Just we probably mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast. But if you haven't seen the films, we aren't going to spoil any of the films. So don't worry. You can watch them after this interview if you want to. We do recommend. I think they'll enhance the interview. If you want to pause it right now, go watch them and come back. I think they would enhance it. But if you're worried about it, we're not going to spoil any of the films. But if they want to find them, where should our audience look for your films?
So to be honest, I was vlogging and I kind of got a clutter of different short films and vlogs on YouTube. And for now, for the past 6 months, I've been focused on 3 short films, 2 of them being in editing phase. And the third one I'm completing in the next, perhaps by 17th of July. Yeah, that's the last shooting date. So the plan is to take all these short films to different festivals in Europe and then in America as well. Some of these festivals, they do not let you have a public posting on any social media platform. And they want you to bring the content just to them so the film fair audience can actually have a look at it. And then you can go and have a premiere on a digital platform or something like that. So these inhibitions, I mean, specifically in Germany and in France. So we came across 2 different film festivals that basically just told us to the content that you're creating needs to come directly to us, does not need to go anywhere else before. So these films we are taking to different film festivals, but eventually in about 8 to 9 months, that's what I have a rough timeline about them, they will be coming out on YouTube only on our specific channel. The channel would be called The Storyteller.
Awesome. And I know that there are some films that are available on YouTube now. In the podcast description will be a link to what is available now, and hopefully, like Amar just told you, come a little bit later, a little bit down the road, you'll be able to see the stuff that he's bringing to festivals this year. And there's a little bit of a back catalog that you can check out. So check out the podcast description and you can see those short films on YouTube there. Yeah, I didn't want to get too into it because you were already giving us such in-depth answers into like your background and how that influences your films. I didn't want to go too far into it without, you know, letting our audience know if they want to check it out, where they can find them. And we'll remind you guys at the end of the interview as well about that. So you kind of mentioned it, I guess. Yeah, this might be retreading, but we wanted to know like your start in filmmaking. Obviously, you went over like how like, you know, growing up in Pakistan, you were watching the, you know, the copyright laws obviously influence your journey. And then you kind of just went for it, it sounds like, at a certain point.
Yeah.
But was there like a spark or anything that like, was there someone in your life that kind of pushed you to it? Or was there anything that influenced you, or was it just came from you like within?
To be honest, what happened was I come from a business family and I was always involved into business and finance and all that. And I did go through a little bit of heartbreak that everybody goes through. And then, you know, I went into depression. And that depression phase, I mean, introduced me to Pacino, De Niro, Scorsese, Dustin Hoffman. You know, you name them, I can keep naming them, but Scorsese is someone that I could not stop watching films for. And, you know, imagine a kid in a middle city of Pakistan, stuck in his room because he's depressed, and all he sees is Scorsese films, and comes out as someone who talks about a film that does not connect with the local culture or language. But everybody knows when Pacino yells the word fuck, or, you know, when... when De Niro takes out a taxi and stuff, the entire world knows about it. And my grandfather was a huge influence on me. He lived most of his life in England. And back in the 70s and, you know, the golden era, as they call it, he became friends with one of the people in the ABBA and went around. He came to the States for Woodstock, went to England from Glastonbury. And then he was someone who actually realized that I was going through a depressive phase in my life. And all I had was movies and pizza. But there was some creative inclination that I was coming up with. And I remember having long phone calls with him discussing film ideas and how a film that was made in Hollywood could be made in Pakistan. And, you know, call it copying or, you know, stealing an idea. But that process kind of introduced me towards what filmmaking was and what story was. And somehow I was someone with big dreams. Now, Hollywood, I mean, Hollywood and Bollywood in India are perhaps the biggest film industries in the world, Chinese as well. But at that time, I thought that Pakistan, the country that I was living in, had a massive industry similar to Hollywood or Bollywood. What would a teenager think? He would want to be De Niro in whatever part of the world he was. So I went out, met a couple of people in advertising and asked them that I wanted to be a part of their film and I wanted to act. And I did a couple of TV commercials. I did a couple of cameos in a film, in a drama on national television. And there was a time where I ended up watching Friends. And I made a 15-episode sitcom in Pakistan with just the basic filmmaking equipment. I mean, I just went out and started filming myself, fearlessly, to be honest. I made a lot of mistakes. People laughed on it. But that journey kind of led me towards realizing that, you know, these stories, they need much more hard work and a lot of blood and sweat.
How would you say that your style has evolved from those days? Obviously, you've learned that there is a lot more that goes into production and pre-production and kind of polishing the fine edges. But what were some like specific lessons that you learned along the way, maybe?
So the best thing that could have happened, and something that I cherish, is that I started off in films as an actor. That made me focus on expression first. I mean, how to express someone's story. I was looking at dialogues, I was looking at expressions, I was looking at situations. But then eventually what happened was that I started taking interest in the visuals, in how the thing was getting made. And that kind of tilted my interest towards direction. Now, I was an actor who kept jumping on and off camera just because he wanted to see the shot he was in or the shot the other people were in. And that kind of led me towards direction. It tilted from expression to the visual. And then eventually what happened was that I realized in about 3 years after that sitcom that I made, I personally think that it's all about the story. I think it's all about the script. If you've got a good script, you can get a weak actor and still make it work, but you cannot get a bad visual and try to make it work, you know? I mean, as long as you got the visuals and the story correct, I think everything else falls into place. And that journey from starting with expression, tilting towards visualization, and then coming towards writing myself and learning screenplay and coming up with scripts, I mean, that brought me towards where I am right now. I mean, now I love writing my own stories. And I do get this feedback, though, sometimes, and a lot of times, to be honest, which is like this, you know, the way you write your dialogues has a mix of British English and the way Americans speak English. And what I do to sort that out is that I just tell my actors that, you know what it's about, you know what the dialogue's about, just wing it. As long as you're in the frame, as long as you're in the story structure, just wing it. So for me, I started off as an actor, and I write, and then I direct them as well.
And did you ever have any sort of, obviously I'm not saying this like you need to or anyone needs to, because I certainly don't come from that background at all, but did you ever have any sort of formal training? Did you ever take any sort of class on screenwriting, or did you kind of just have it for yourself?
I never had any sort of formal training. I just saw people making films, and I went out, worked in advertising, got some money saved together. I put that money out into a team, which was from final year film students from Pakistan. And I just, a couple of them I invited for internships, and two of them I actually paid for a salary for the month. And the equipment, the film equipment, I just rented it. So the money that I saved, I actually invested that money on making this silly sitcom. And you know, it's that sitcom, it's full of mistakes. But when I look at it, I realize that, you know, this was the place where I started learning from. Because, you know, one of these episodes is about 15 minutes. The other one is about 17 minutes. The next one is about 13 minutes. I couldn't even get the duration right because the script was also something that I was learning from. So I did invest on it myself. I came on this road myself, and I just watched films. And eventually I realized that I had to come and have a degree in this and see where, you know, life takes me here. So that's why I came around and did a film degree here.
Do you think that that kind of plays into your improvisational approach to working with actors? You kind of like improvised your career. You were like, I'm going to wing it. I'm going to teach myself. And that clearly has worked for you. Do you think that that influences your approach to working with actors and saying like, here's the story, here's the beats, here's the emotions, let's figure it out from there?
I love your question. I mean, I love it because I've been highly influenced by, I mean, everyone's influenced by Hitchcock, by, you know, you can name all these big names, but I think Tarantino is someone who does commercialization with his characters and stuff. But the journey that you're talking about is something that helps me make these characters. And, you know, their character arcs, even in a story, if someone just enters into an act, I know where he's coming from, what he is, what he wants, what his name is, what his race is, where he's from, and what his angle is to the entire thing. And then when he goes out of the story, that's when I realized that, you know, I've known this guy and this is how he reacts. So my own journey kind of helps me build those little journeys in a story as well. So yes, it does help. It does help.
Speaking of working with actors, the story being so important to you, the story structure, what does your writing process look like? I love asking this question because every writer has a different approach. Some start with the characters, some start with the ending, some start with the overall theme. What does that look like for you?
For me, it is important to know what the main idea is, what the main storyline is. I mean, what are the turning points? What are the transitions? How it's going to start, how it's going to end, how it's going to fade. So I like the subject first. Similarly, you know, like a child does when he reads his first novel. So if the story attracts and it makes me feel that, you know, this story is worth telling and worth bringing out, I tend to be, and this is what my professors also thought throughout my study period, that I'm a dialogue writer. And I kind of like creating situations where characters react towards each other. And these reactions kind of make me help build the entire storyline. And once I'm done with the storyline, then I move on to working on the transitions and the phases that it fades into and fades out of. The one thing that sometimes I have trouble with, but I think it's a good thing, which is that while I write my script, I know the visual it's going to come out as. I mean, I can literally write my short list on my script So it kind of messes up my communication with my team, to be honest. All the projects I've worked with, my producers, they had a problem. They thought that I was talking about the story when I had jumbled up the visual in it as well. And I was literally talking about the emotion the visual would come out with. But all they were concerned with, what was on the paper, what was on the script, what the character was saying, what the transition was. And I would somehow be selling to them the emotion the visual would be bringing out. So yes, I do have that. And I kind of have trouble in communicating this to my team. But in the end, it kind of works out for me because I can see the film while I'm writing it, if that makes it more easier.
Yeah, 100%. Do you find this kind of like a two-pronged question? I wanted to ask you, like, when you're making a film, how big is that team that you're working with to make that film? And then what are some strategies maybe that you've developed over time to communicate better to them what your vision is for a scene?
So when I'm done with my shot list and I've had my meeting with my DOP, I make sure that my actors and my DOP, so the DOP and the actors, they're basically on the same page that I am as, because I want them to know what the shot is about. I want them to know where it is, what the angle is going to be, where the camera is going to be. And for all of this to fall together, you got to make sure what the location is. So the first thing that I lock down whenever I'm filming is the location. As soon as I'm done locking the location down and got my actors on DOP on the same page as mine, it kind of helps me manage my team according to the shoot at the certain location. Now, the recent film that I did, it's called, I'm still doing it, it's called Twin Flames. And it was supposed to be shot in three different locations. One of them we've already done was in Princeton on Witherspoon Street, La Mezzaluna. There's a restaurant there. And we shot in there because it had a beautiful window. And we had a shot where a girl basically crosses the street while we have a three shot inside the restaurant. And we see this beautiful girl crossing the street in that shot, kind of like a Dolly effect, to be honest, in Pulp Fiction. But anyway, so we had Princeton, we had New York, and then we have a cabin in woods, which is a bit down south towards Pennsylvania. So it's about this writer who thinks he's a writer, but the bubble breaks because he meets a real film guy in his life. And then it leads on to his breaking up on something he loves, giving up on it, and then coming back to it. So once we locked the locations for all these three different setups, what happened was that we were able to identify how many people at what time and where we would be needing them. So basically, the story was actually telling us, the location was kind of telling us how many people we need. And trust me, I thought that we'd be taking a lot of people to New York, but we are not. We're literally, it's only about seven people traveling there, and three of them are actors. So the other four is basically the DOP, the director, the sound guy, and one guy for the reflectors and for the diffusers. So the location kind of helps us decide what kind of team we want. We don't get team fixed in the beginning, specifically for college level independent films. You get a lot of people who you can ask to come on board and just be a part of it. But to make something, you got to lock a team. So the smallest team I have for the nicest story I have is a goal for me. It's something that I go for.
And when you're looking for collaborators, or when you're finding people who you're going to collaborate with, is there something that you look for when you're recruiting people, or are there certain things that you're noticing work better when you're, like, are there certain attributes that work better with you, you know, that, like, you kind of work with those people better, or are there certain things that, like, maybe you're, oh, like, I'm good at this aspect, I'm not so good at this other aspect, so I should get someone who is good at that other aspect so they can kind of pick me up? Are there anything like that where, like, there's certain things that stick out to you when you're looking for collaborators?
See, the thing is that personally, I have not been very efficient or successful in looking up digital collaborators, but I have been getting in contact with people who actually made films and took them to festivals. A couple of them are New York film students from NYU, and two of them happened to be from the same community that I'm from. One, her name's Michelle Harding. She made a film, Farmhand, about a year and a half ago. And this was a college level student who actually made a film and brought it to Amazon, and Amazon picked it up. So we have a college level student who made a film, and basically you can watch it now on Amazon. That, for me, is a huge achievement. So the first thing I kind of focused on was to meet like-minded people rather than collaborators and promoters. I kind of wanted to go towards like-minded people, considering the fact that, you know, I haven't lived here my entire life, so I don't have many friends over here. And considering that, I wanted to just go out and meet people and make friends with people who were into films. And for me, the primary objective has been that. Michelle Harding, kind of, I met a lot of people through her as well, a lot of people through my professors. And I think this field has the biggest creative differences and ego issues when it comes to people and making them work together in a team. People phase out, man. People hate each other and then people love each other. It's crazy. So even if you're making a 2-minute film, it's important that you're making it with the people that have the same mind as you. I mean, they have the same way of thinking. So the first thing that you've got to work at is to find these people. And this kind of reminds me about the meeting you and I had. And, you know, you just walked up and, you know, you had that. I just like, are you into films? I looked at your T-shirt. I was like, are you into films? He said, yeah. I was like, I'm into films too. And that's how actually our conversation started. So I kind of respect that. I think people skills are more important for this. You got to know who you're working with. If you're working with someone who's bound to end up with an ego issue, it's just going to fuck up your entire film.
Yeah, obviously our audience hasn't heard the story yet, but yeah, meeting each other was very, the film god stepping in, I feel like. Yeah. You know, kind of the connection right there. Yeah, the Quentin Tarantino shirt that I was wearing sparked the conversation. And then it was like, wait, what? He's like, yeah, I'm making a film. I'm making it, what? Oh, it's very organic in that way. And I love that. I definitely have told Gardner that story more than once already. He's probably sick of hearing it, but
yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And it's cool how many people you find that are interested or film adjacent.
Yeah.
That are somewhat in the industry or know someone in the industry or, you know, they're like one step away from it. There's a lot of people who not only watch films, but are knowing about the background of it too, I think, more than you would think, at least. That's what I've found since starting this podcast and since talking to people about it. It's like everyone knows someone, it feels like, who is in some way tangentially related to it. And it's very interesting in that aspect. Talking about your collaborators, this is probably a question that we should start telling everyone. It's like we ask everyone question because I feel like it is in most of our interviews. But when you're working with cast members and even people behind the scenes, like producers, editors, whatever, there's a million other jobs. I shouldn't, you know, just limit it to those, but et cetera. I'm not going to list off everyone on a film. But whenever you're working with them, cast members and behind the scenes people, do you find yourself wanting to create a team that you want to continue to work with? I know we've just mentioned my Tarantino shirt, and I kind of always reference Tarantino with this question where, you know, he's obviously got his actors, and Scorsese, who you mentioned before, does it too. He's had obviously tons of actors like Keitel, De Niro, DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Tons of other ones that are just in a bunch of his films.
Yeah.
Everyone does it. You know, PTA has his actors as well. I'm just naming a couple of my favorites right there. But
yeah,
a lot of more very well-known filmmakers, at least from maybe, I guess, maybe more of the past now, because none of them are like up-and-coming filmmakers, obviously, that I've mentioned. But
yeah,
do you see yourself getting like, I really like having this guy in my films and I want him in like all of them, like that type of thing? Do you see yourself kind of looking for a new cast each time?
Yeah, I would love to have that, because I kind of grew up watching that relation, and, you know, I call them the better filmmakers. I mean, the better filmmakers and the better actors, they had the same relation. But something that it's just sometimes painful to say this, but our generation is totally not connected like that. I might be wrong, but I feel there's a lot of less heart into everything now. And people are like going for short-term goals rather than actually trusting and investing in each other. And by investing, I don't mean money, I mean time. And I still think that, you know, I've been an actor and I loved acting in films where the director kind of gave me an energy or a little confidence and made me feel that he kind of knows what's happening and he knows where this is going to and what he wants from me. That kind of made me trust him. But on the other end, if it's an actor that has an attitude issue, which normally, frankly, to be honest, a lot of them now do have that. So, you know, if he has that, and if he's not able to build a trust issue with the director, it just turns out into incomplete projects. And wherever you go, independent filmmakers are living with incomplete projects everywhere. Possibly the main reason, not the right people. So I think you got to be connected in heart and soul with someone you just got to be innocently friends with. And you could talk about shit from your first grade to the recent shit that you went through. And, you know, you know about each other's life. You know who you are. And then I think you can actually sit down on one story and work through it. I got to tell you something. Right? I mean, this question just makes me remember that. Do you remember the film Casino?
Oh, yeah.
So Bob De Niro and Don Rickles, right? So they showed a few outtakes on the night they basically sent off Don Rickles. You know, that big night they have in New York. I don't remember the names, but they recorded him. So it was Don Rickles' night, and Scorsese and De Niro basically came out on stage and wished him well and all that. And they showed this outtake from that film. Now, De Niro's literally he's looking at a script. He's remembering his dialogue, and he's trying to say it out loud. Scorsese is on camera. He's got the camera ready. And Don Rickles is standing just in front of De Niro, helping him out with the dialogue, only because he's got his point of view. And because of the point of view, he needs to stand there. So Scorsese and De Niro, probably pulling one, want Don Rickles to stand in front of De Niro. And while he's just looking through his script and, you know, working on his character, Don Rickles looks at him and he says, "Could you just act and let go of this method acting bullshit for once?" So you got to have that humor. You got to have the ability to laugh at each other and still be together and work on something with a good energy. There was another one where De Niro actually came out and told that, you know, for Taxi Driver, he went out and got a taxi driver license, drove taxi around the entire city for a couple of weeks, learned how the streets were and learned what the people actually go with and what the shit on street is. And that really helped him build character. And this was something he was narrating to Don Rickles. And Don Rickles replies, he says, "So why didn't you just try acting?" I mean, so I'm not saying that these are big guns or, you know, big actors. I'm just saying that they're very humble and normal, good people who brought good stories. And they're just good friends, even in their old age. I mean, you know, with one leg in the grave and stuff, you can actually look at them and feel the energy that, you know, they're just great.
Speaking of that, clearly you were very influenced by Scorsese in particular and those actors, De Niro, Rickles, Pacino. Are there any actors or actresses working in Hollywood today that you really look up to, that you would love to get the chance to work with if that so happened to come along?
Dude, I like the guy who did Elvis. I mean, I watched Elvis last night. I like the guy in Baby Driver. What's his name?
Ansel Elgort and Austin Butler, I think, are the two guys.
Yeah, both of them. And then there's this British guy in... I'm sorry, I'm bad with names. But you know the Eggsy film, The Kingsman?
Yeah.
The guy who played Eggsy.
Oh, yeah. Taron Egerton, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. So I think these three guys are pretty promising actors. They have a lot of dough, as they call it. And, you know, they'd be able to pull big films. I love Margot Robbie. I think she's amazing. And Amber, what's her name, Amber? Do you know the one in Silver Linings Playbook?
Oh, Jennifer Lawrence?
Yes, I love her.
These are great picks.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, so far, so good. Not that I'm surprised. There are a lot of very talented actors and actresses out there.
Yeah.
Definitely, you're not hitting any bad ones. I'll say that. Everyone you've mentioned so far has been definitely someone that would be amazing to work with, I think. So.
Yeah. But, you know, I still believe that, you know, so now that I've started film, I mean, I came across this mindset where people were like that, you know, a film actor is a film actor. And, you know, the dialogue needs to be crispier. It needs to be shorter. And the theater actor is a theater actor. Call me old school, but I don't believe in that bullshit. I think a theater actor, if controlled by the dynamics of a filmmaking set, is a gem. The way he expresses on camera, there's nothing like it. I mean, there was a reason Francis Ford Coppola fought for Pacino with Paramount and everything for The Godfather. All the studios wanted to invest on De Niro and Hoffman and all that. But this guy wanted this particular stage actor who had done a Panic in Needle Park to come and play Michael Corleone. So, I mean, that says a lot about storytelling and belief in your idea.
And you mentioned earlier that you started off as an actor.
Yeah.
And then transitioned into, I struggle to say behind the scenes, because writing and directing is so in front of the, you know, that is the scene. It's not, you know what I mean? It's not necessarily behind the scenes, but
yeah,
into that kind of stuff as well. Would you ever consider acting in something that you yourself wrote?
Yeah, I would love to. Because in fact, in one of these films, I'm doing a role myself as well, but it's like a short role. The beauty of writing and directing is that it's only the writer who knows who the basically film lead is. Even if you decided at the beginning who's going to be the hero and who's going to be the, you know, you lay it all down. I think in the end, it's only the writer that actually knows which character is going to go where through the entire arc. And that kind of makes me, it's fun to have a character in that little universe you've created and then play him yourself. You know, it's I kind of like that. I'm not sure if I would write an entire film and do it myself. I don't know. That's too much.
Would you ever consider directing somebody else's script and then getting in front of the camera in that situation?
Oh, that's painful for me, to be honest, because what happened was, I mean, that's the reason I'm probably still an independent filmmaker. Only recently in my college, I was working in a theater play, and the theater play eventually got canceled. But what happened was that because of the rehearsals, I couldn't come up with my own film in the last semester at the college. So my professor called me up and he says, I mean, with all the extra time you have in this busy, shitty routine you have right now, if you could just go around and help other people with their film projects, I'd give you a grade. And, you know, I'd mark you on that and see what kind of value you bring into their films. And I'm like, okay, that kind of makes sense. And he looks at me dead in the eye and he says, do not read their scripts, because I know you. If you read them, you're going to fuck it up. You won't be able to work for it. Because the thing is, dude, if I come up with Tinkerbell in Peter Pan, and if it makes me want to get out there in the hot day we had today and film and, you know, come across different people, the idea needs to make me do that. It's like method acting. The idea needs to make me do that. If the idea is bad, and if I don't feel attracted to it, and if I don't like it, I don't want to be holding a boom mic or deciding what lens I want or what schedule I have or what location I have. I don't want to go through all that shit. I'm sorry, but it's just painful for me. So I'm kind of someone who loves working hard for my own story.
And since we're talking about you wanting to write your own stuff and wanting to direct things that you write, when you're writing something, are there themes or topics that you like to write about or that you kind of want to bring into your films? Or does everything kind of just, you let the story go where it goes and it tells you what to do?
I don't know. I have a really cluttered way of thinking, because what I mean by that is that if I were to write a film on YouTube, people, right? If I were to cast you guys and make a film about this show, right? I have the basic idea in my mind that, you know, it's a show that these guys do, and it's about these two people who bring on filmmakers and interview them and stuff. Now, the only thing that I'd be focusing on was how to make this interesting. And the first thing I have is just to make sure that the way it flows and the way it transitions has those conflicts, those turning points in it, those little dots in the entire rhythm of the story that makes it interesting. I need those characters. And I kind of, once I finalize the idea, I'm kind of focusing on the characters and where they're from and what they do. Because trust me, my friends laugh at this, but I say that if you were to make Friends or How I Met Your Mother again today, instead of making them look way too modern or way too advanced in cultural inclinations, instead of just making five different people from different parts of the world and different religions coming down in one apartment in New York, which is basically the truth of New York today. I mean, you've got people from everywhere. I see a lot of humor when all these different people live in under one roof. It's just, yes, there are differences, and, you know, there might be things people might frown upon, but the differences has the humor in it. And if that comes out, the story becomes interesting, similar to what we are doing right now with three different people, but the differences kind of makes it interesting. You know, that interest, that's something I get focused on, what the character is, how the flow is going to go out. And then the locations help. It makes me decide what kind of shots I want and stuff. Yeah, so it's all jumbled up.
And you've covered a lot of the different aspects of your filmmaking process up until this point, the writing process, the production process. I'm curious, what does the post-production process look like for you, the editing process, and about how long does it typically take for you to finish a film?
Dude, my post-production is the quickest you can get. I'm not boasting. With all humility, I say this. Because the thing is that I make my shot list on my script, and I know the shots that my script is going to come out with. So basically, it's like bringing a cloth to a private tailor and telling him where to stitch what. And then once he's stitched the entire thing together, you just tell him, all right, add value to it as much as you can. But don't give me options on the visual. I know the visual. Just upgrade the entire thing. Work on the sound, work on the color, work on, you know, work on anything else. But do not mess with my rhythm of the entire shortlist. So when I go into post-production, because of that planned shortlist, my post-production process is fairly quicker if you compare it.
And since we're talking about literally every aspect of filmmaking right now, and we're talking about your involvement in certain parts of it and your less involvement in other aspects, you know, your hands-off approach to certain aspects, your very hands-on approach to other aspects of it, which I love. Obviously, some filmmakers are hands-on to everything where they need their, what some would call a control freak, where they need to be like the one doing the sound themselves as well, you know.
Oh, no.
Sounds like you're a little less controlling than that, obviously, but
yeah,
that's not a shot at anyone who is like that. That's,
yeah,
obviously, we're just joking around there. But since we're talking about every aspect of filmmaking and writing, post-production, filming itself, what would you say the most challenging aspect of the entire process is?
I don't know. For me personally, it's been finding actors I can connect with and actors who can basically invest in the story and learn about the universe, know what the universe is about, know what the other characters are about. I don't want to bring an insult or something like that to the table, but I think TikTok is something different from filmmaking. And 90% of the people we have in the resource flux now think it's going to be a really fun day. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be a nice time. No. It's like labor. It's like a steel factory. It's like a wood factory, you know? It's like a furnace. You go in, you work your sweat and bones off. And, you know, it's perhaps... So, you know, there's something interesting I'd like to tell. My grandfather was into construction. And the first time I did something in filmmaking, I went back and he said that, you know what, tell me about this. Imagine a beautiful gentleman from the 70s who gives no fucks about filmmaking. You know, one of those era people. He sits down and in a very Marlon Brando-ish style, he goes like, what is it about? You know, tell me what's it about. And this is a construction contractor I'm sitting in front of. And I say that, you know, we got the sound team, we got the light team, we got the camera team, we got the actors, and, you know, we all of them, we work together, and then we get the footage, and then we edit it. So he keeps listening to it, and then he says, oh, so it's like construction. So you got to work in 6 different teams that work in sync, and then you get something out, you know? And I was pretty surprised at that. And I, to be honest, learned a lot by that, because I think it is a lot of hard work. Everybody needs to be on the same page. If you're having fun with how he's acting, how the actor's acting, but the sound guy's got the boom mic flipped up. I mean, yeah, you got to look into these nitty-gritties.
What aspect of filmmaking would you say comes most naturally to you?
The story and the characters and the music. Either, though I'm not a musician, I mean, I got nothing to do with music, but I just like how the visuals come alive with just a soundtrack.
How do you work getting music into your films? Do you have musician friends that you work with? Do you buy the rights to songs? What is your process there?
To be honest, right now, I'm just focused on low budget films. The idea is to make a film. So one of these films is, the aim is to make them under $300. We use the New Hope Town, you know, the New Hope Railroad around here. It's beautiful, Pennsylvanians. So the idea was to make a film under $250. The other plan was to make a film under $500. And the third one that we're making right now is a plan to make it under $1,000. That kind of affects everything. When you budget your entire thing, that affects everything. But that kind of brings you towards a world filled with people who are willing to offer their work just for free. And I happen to come across a lot of people who actually were doing pretty good music. One of them is actually doing the background score of my next film. His grandfather used to be a rock and roll band back in the 70s, and he got these records that he never sold. I mean, he has a Spotify account, but he's got these unlicensed, unregistered records all around. And we just went out, sat down and listened to it. And one of these tracks, I mean, I fell in love with it. I was like, you know, it just talks my film to me. So I think the element of music is no matter where you find and who, which artists you're connected with, I respect the fact. I'm not one of those filmmakers who's going to say, you should make your own music. If you can get already made music and pay a little fee for it on online platforms, well, then you're lucky as hell because, you know, you got to work extra hard to get that music. Now, a film for a $1,000 budget, you cannot go out and buy. So the best option you have is to go to all these platforms, have subscriptions, get some music soundtracks down or something, or find the few artists you know who can actually bring value to the story and ask them to be a part of it. So there's no buying out, there's no licensing or anything. There's just independent artists coming together.
So you've teased this already. You've mentioned that you have three films in production right now.
Yeah.
Two of which are in the editing stage and one of which will be done within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Give or take a couple days from the release of this interview. So is there anything, I know you can't go into the festivals, you can't release them publicly until they get to the festivals. There's rules behind that. You're not being secretive to our audience. The rules you have to follow, obviously. But is there anything about these films that you can tease to our audience? Is there anything you want to tell them about what you're working on now that you can share? Or is it all just kind of when I share it with you, you can see it then?
I can share something. I mean, because I don't think there's any harm in sharing the idea to an extent. So the primary objective that I have whenever I write a story is the relatability it might have to an audience. If people can relate to it, you know, I feel like the story is strong enough. Now, when I think about film festivals, I think that the audience that I'm taking a film to is some group of people that already knows films. So this film that we're working on is about self-proclaimed writer who sits in the corner of a coffee shop every day, dominating the college people around him with his excessive film knowledge and living the image that he has created himself, that, you know, he knows shit about film. He's this big film guy who has all the knowledge and all the music and all that. And he's just a big sellout. By that, what I mean, he's constantly selling himself to the other people that, you know, he knows shit and all that. And he knows a couple of fancy names of different filmmakers and he knows a couple of film terms. And he kind of impresses people with that. And he has a girlfriend who's a waitress. She kind of believes in his stupid ideas. But then it kind of leads up to him meeting a film producer, a real life film producer, hoping to get his stories aboard. And that kind of changes everything for him. It's kind of self-reflection and it tells him, you know, a big slap in the face, bringing him back to reality. That's the story about that. And I think the topic, though I haven't given out the entire film yet, I think the topic is very relatable to the film audience because painfully, there are more film lovers than filmmakers these days. It's just a sad reality, to be honest. More critique than creativity.
Speaking of creativity, you're in the process of working on several films and you got some coming down the pike. Looking toward the future, do you have a feature film in mind?
I would love to, but to be honest, for now, I would want to focus on short films. I think in my own weird little head that the future is short films. I mean, I don't know why I say that so, you know, in a cliche style, but the reason I just said it is because I look at attention spans. The attention span of the audience has drastically went down. Our parents or the generation behind us, they were used to going out and watching 3-hour long films, having a good time, having dinner, and then coming back. Today, the audience literally has a panic attack in the middle of a 1-hour film, 1.5-hour film, and they got their anxieties flared up. And, you know, if they don't like something in the film, it affects them emotionally more than it ever did. And people literally, I've seen people walking out, despite the fact that it's a good film, people just walk out. They don't have that long attention span anymore. I mean, Netflix can be paused anytime. A theater can't be, but all these online platforms, they can be paused at any time. And I don't know. But in my weird head, I feel that's a really bad thing. I mean, I've worked hard making a film. Why would you just fucking pause it? And, you know, that means it's a shitty film. And, you know, gives me more time to reflect on it. A good film would keep you intact, would just make you sit there and, you know, force you to use your hands for the popcorn only. So I think that the future, in a way, is towards short films. I think the duration would drastically come down. And the TikTok audience is going to need a 15-minute, 20-minute film. That's what I think. So that's what I'm focused on right now.
Since we are getting to the end of the interview, we have a question that we like to ask all of our guests, which is there or are there an independent filmmaker or filmmakers that you would like to recommend to us and our audience that maybe we haven't heard of, maybe we have heard of, but someone that you would like to shine a light on?
Yes, Michelle Harding. She was a student in Mercer County Community College, and I respect her a lot. Someone I've met and I admire, because she was someone who was brave enough to make a film in community college and actually went out to sell it on a online platform, which was Amazon. So you have a community college student that made a film in a budget and bought it out on Amazon. So she's someone who actually went the entire journey. So a lot to learn from there. And I think she'd be a perfect fit for your show.
Awesome. We'll definitely follow up with that and try to get her on.
Yeah, I can connect you with her.
That would be amazing. I definitely can't wait to watch. Definitely going to be adding that. I love one of my favorite parts about streaming. I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent very shortly right now. Is there are faults with a lot of new technology, streaming being one of them. There are faults to streaming. There's a downside to streaming and people's jobs. You've seen it with Netflix recently. But box office numbers will show you too that streaming sometimes is hurting the film industry more than it's helping. Netflix has realized that their model wasn't working. But what I will say, a really cool aspect of streaming and Amazon Prime in particular, not that no free ads, but it is not that hard to get recommended films on some platforms that are lesser known. So I'll be on Amazon Prime sometimes and I'll be scrolling through like, oh, the classic, you're going through They have thousands of films on there. And you're like, all right, let me just scroll through the ether and add to my list. Let's say, find one to watch. And I'll be scrolling through Amazon Prime and you'll notice that I'll start watching a film. And then afterwards I look it up and I find out, oh, this is like a super low budget movie that I just watched that was made by someone who's really just like for the love of the game doing this.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to check out Michelle Harding's, I believe you said it was Farmhand on Amazon?
Farmhand.
Yeah, I cannot wait to check that out. And I love that filmmakers have that ability to get their...
Yeah.
It's still not easy. I'm not saying, oh, like, if you're trying to make a film right now and you're having trouble getting it out there, trust me, you're not the only one. And it's not easy still to this day to get feature-length films and short films out there. It's hard to get them out to audiences, for sure.
Yeah.
But it is cool that things like Amazon Prime exist to give voices to independent filmmakers like that and other ones. I've found a lot of great films just by scrolling through.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'll recommend you some good stuff.
Yeah, it kind of gives more opportunity to other people as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And Farmhand, even if you look at it, I mean, Farmhand is not a long duration film. It's just, I think it's about nearly an hour and it's on Amazon. So we got people working, you know, quite a lot and getting their stuff out there, you know?
Yeah, and that's what one thing we love to do here is to shine a light on these underrepresented filmmakers who aren't getting enough shine.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you had her at the top of the mind. We can shout it out and we can say to our audience, go check it out. I know we will be watching that very shortly.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also a little bit, obviously, fun for us because I always say I don't like to speak for Gardner, but I'll speak for myself right now. I just like hearing the recommendations because it just means here's a new filmmaker that I can check out myself. So a little selfishness on my part. But yes, the audience also gets to hear the recommendations and checks them out too. But it's really cool because I know I'll be watching Farmhand this week. Cannot wait. Michelle Harding, Farmhand, Amazon Prime. Anyone who is listening now and wants to check it out, we will be checking that out for sure. Definitely really appreciate you not only sharing that, but sharing all the aspects of your process and telling us about what you're working on, how you do what you do, and giving us a lot of insight into the background of how it gets done. Because I think a lot of what we like to talk about, at least, and hopefully what our audience likes to hear, is the process, right? And how someone is able to make an independent film. I mean, you said $300 is your budget for most of these short films. That's very impressive, obviously.
Yeah.
Especially with what you're able to accomplish. So it's really cool. We really do appreciate not only you spending the time with us, but sharing your work with us and then letting us pick your brain and get to know how you make those films, because we are very excited to see what comes next. I know I'm going to be super excited to see the finished product of all three of those and whatever comes next afterwards, but all three of the ones in production right now. But a big thank you for spending the time with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me on this, bro. Thank you very much. It's really kind of you. Had a pleasure talking to all.
Yeah, anytime.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
All right.
All right.
There you have it, folks. That was our interview with Amar Farouk. We hope you enjoyed it. Thank you to Amar for joining us. We really appreciate it. Hopefully we can have him back on one day to talk about more of his work or maybe to talk about one of his favorites. We really do appreciate it. So Amar, thank you for stopping by.
Amar, thank you for coming on the show. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. Getting to talk to Amar was just a lot of fun. He had some really interesting insights and definitely a unique perspective to what we've had on the podcast before. Definitely go check out his work. Thank you for coming on the show, man.
Thank you as well to our listeners. Thank you to our recurring listeners as well as our new listeners. We hope you enjoyed this episode and we hope you stick around for more. That wraps up the show. Remember, you can find all of our back catalog of episodes anywhere you listen to podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the free ones. You can find us by searching the letters G, D, T, and then you can subscribe, leave a 5-star review if you want, and you'll never miss an episode. You can also find us on social media where we are at Good Data Pod on Instagram and Twitter and at GDT Podcast on Facebook. Follow us there. We post all of our new episodes, so you'll really never miss one if you do. And that is the end of the show. Stay tuned for our episodes next week. Like I said, we'll be definitely talking about Iron Man 3, something on Thursday. And then we have another interview next week with Australian filmmaker Ben Young. So stay tuned for that. Get excited for it. You can check it out, his movies Extraction on Netflix and Hounds of Love, which is available. I know it's on Tubi. You can also rent it if you don't want to watch any ads, but definitely check out his work before that interview. We have a lot of fun talking to him, and that does end the show. So thank you guys for listening. We will talk to you again next week.
As always, thank you for tuning in, folks. We love you. We'll see you on the next one.